It is a great pleasure to welcome to this conversation Rico Friedrich, Executive Director and Portfolio Manager of Denker Capital, based in Cape Town, South Africa. Rico, it's terrific to have you here. I look forward to learning from you about investing. Perhaps just at the outset, you could tell us a little bit more about Denker and your own path in investing so we can understand where you're coming from.
Great. Thanks, John. And thank you very much for the opportunity. I really appreciate the introduction from Guy. I've learned an incredible amount from your interviews over the years, and I'm really looking forward to our chat. Yeah, I think if I sort of had to go back and look at my path over the last 20 years, I've been incredibly fortunate in that I knew pretty early on, even in my later years in school, of what I wanted to do. I always had a fascination with business. My father was an entrepreneur. He was actually a shop owner in household textiles. And, you know, we'd spend many dinners talking about his business and what had happened during the day. And, you know, some of the first sort of lessons I learned in investing actually came from those discussions. I mean, one in particular that I remember quite vividly was, you know, my father had often had the opportunity to buy huge discounted containers of products that had been rejected by customers from a manufacturer. You know, as a result, he could get those at a bargain basement price. And he would then mark them up in his shop and sell exactly the same product as, say, a high-end retailer down the road. And the stuff wouldn't move. And, you know, he was a bit puzzled by this. And he would then, after chatting to people, they would say, but this can't be the same product as the high-end retailer because it's just too cheap. So he would mark the stuff up, which would now, you know, go from, say, an 80% discount to what the retailer down the road was selling it at, to now only a 30% discount, and the stuff would fly out the door. And the lesson that I learned very early on there was that, you know, the price of an item may have very little or nothing to do with the value or its actual worth. I also learned then, sort of as I was going through my university, that I didn't want to get stuck into a profession that charged by the hour. So when I finished my articles as a chartered accountant, I joined Franklin Templeton in South Africa. I was one of the first employees in that business when they set up their asset management company in SA in 1998. And that was a fantastic indoctrination. Shortly after that, we had the emerging market crisis, which was around August of 1998. I joined in April. So, you know, my first couple of months were all around managing money in times of crises. And this sort of recent crisis that we've gone through now is probably my third one. And one never stops learning through these processes. But my first lesson in the profession then was around the danger, particularly of investing in IPOs. You'll recall, although I didn't have the good fortune of working with Sir John Templeton, but he was obviously the founder of that business, and he had retired in 1992, so it's about 6 years before I joined. But you know, one of his big lessons was never invest in an IPO. And we've been through several cycles since then. And the obvious and simple sort of question that one has to ask yourself is, you know, other than the need to raise money to grow a business, generally speaking, a lot of these IPOs happen at a time when the owner of the business believes that they can get more for it than ultimately it's worth. And that, you know, I see as being another very sort of fortunate and valuable lesson early on in my career, which when we come perhaps later on to talk about investing in smaller cap stocks is absolutely critical. You know, just looking at my period at Franklin Templeton, it was a relatively short period, but I learned an enormous amount from I think at that stage, one of the sort of preeminent investors being Sir John Templeton. And some of those valuable lessons included the importance of avoiding the crowd. You know, if you want to achieve an outcome that is different to everybody else, you have to act differently to everybody else. The other sort of second important lesson was searching for bargains, particularly amongst quality stocks. And then lastly, and probably very importantly, especially considering where I think value investing and how it has evolved, particularly over the last 20 years, from the sort of traditional Ben Graham approach to focusing on the importance of the value of future earnings. And therefore, you know, the how important it is to do your homework and detailed due diligences on businesses. And I think if you kind of look back over that period, and maybe in particular the last 10 years or so, I mean, I think the value investors that perhaps have struggled a little bit, or maybe those that have had more of a backward-looking approach rather than, you know, focusing on ultimately sort of net present value of the future cash flow streams of businesses. So the other sort of valuable lesson in my very short period here at Franklin Templeton was the importance of learning from your mistakes. And this is something that we spend a lot of time as a team at Denker Capital looking at, essentially post-mortem. We, you know, through this process have built up a detailed checklist, which consists of about 80 items. And then every year as a team, we go away and spend some time presenting on investment cases that have not worked out as would have been expected. We try and bring those back into our learning process. And we sort of apply it in two ways. One is as a sort of pre-flight checklist when looking at new businesses. But another one is really as an in-flight checklist. So continuously assessing within the investment case is tracking according to how one's initial expectations were. Anyway, after a brief stint at Franklin Templeton, I moved to a business called Sanlam Investments, which at the time was one of the largest life companies in South Africa. After a brief period of as an industrial analyst, I was given the opportunity to take over the small cap franchise within the life business. And that was a fantastic opportunity. I was essentially given a blank piece of paper. That was in around 2002 to 2007, to come up with a strategy that would enable the life business to tap into some of the opportunities within these smaller growing businesses in a booming economy in South Africa at the time. We had a great time. I mean, it was obviously a fantastic bull market from 2002 to 2007. And, you know, honestly, investing in that period was almost like shooting fish in a barrel. It wasn't very hard. But along came the global financial crisis. And since then, in South Africa in particular, we've seen smaller caps struggling to keep up or at least outperform the overall market. And that's not unique to South Africa. We've seen that in the United States. We've seen that in the UK as well. But we still believe that there's it's one of the areas where you can apply your traditional fundamental analysis. There's not a lot of coverage of these companies. The big move to indexing has largely resulted in many of these smaller and in some instances mid-cap stocks being ignored by the market. And in particular, if you sort of look at the more recent crisis that we went through in March, April, you typically find that these smaller caps get sold off more heavily in a risk-off environment. And the sell-off is indiscriminate. You know, it's across the entire spectrum of businesses. And that creates really wonderful, wonderful opportunities. But then after a few years in the focusing mainly on the smaller cap space, in 2011, We actually set up my own firm with a good friend of mine, and that firm eventually culminated into the formation of Denker Capital. We had the backing of my previous employer, and it was an interesting time because it was 3 years after the global financial crisis. And at that stage, I actually had the good fortune of meeting Michael Malbison. And I think if you recall at that period, he was working at Legg Mason with Bo Miller. They'd gone through a particularly difficult time. They had a huge exposure and investment in financials, which obviously were at the forefront of the sell-off in 2008. And they stuck with that position. And unfortunately, that business went from sort of $60 billion of assets down to about $5 billion before they eventually closed it. And Legg Mason was actually out in, Michael Malbison was out in Cape Town at the time. So I reached out to him and we actually engaged in a few conversations. We had dinner together. And I really wanted to learn and understand what went wrong at Legg Mason, because we were about to set up our own business. I thought there would be some really fantastic lessons that we could learn from somebody who had been through this before. And there were some really great insights that I took out from the work that he'd done. He's incredibly generous in sharing some of those lessons with us. But in particular, the one thing that he said was, the cheapness alone is not sufficient to deliver outperformance. And I think, as a value manager, that was really quite an important insight and had a big impact on our investment philosophy and approach going forward. One of the other sort of interesting things that he shared with us from the research that he did was, it was at that point that I really sort of started to understand the strategy that had contributed to the huge success of Berkshire Hathaway over the years. And that was really around this concept of return on incremental invested capital. And a lot of the work that Michael had done that he shared with us was the huge degree of persistency. Good businesses don't become bad businesses overnight and vice versa. And as we know, when looking at the three sources of potential return, which is ultimately a growth in earnings, the starting valuation, if you're looking at it from a PE perspective, and then obviously the change in that rating over time, the biggest contributor over the long term is actually the growth in earnings, which comes down to, the return on incremental capital that a business is able to generate and how long they're able to sustain that return for, relative to their cost of capital. And, at that point, you sort of realize that the Berkshire approach, and obviously they had the right structures in which they could set this up, was around identifying companies that had persistently high return on incremental invested capital and taking very big positions in these businesses. That was something that we said, okay, in setting up Denker Capital, that is the holy grail and the center of sort of our approach to investing. That gives you a little bit of a background in terms of the journey and the history to where we are today.
Terrific. Well, that's a very interesting path in investing that you've had, and obviously running your own firm for nearly 10 years now with Denker. I'd love to delve a little bit deeper into your investment approach and philosophy. You alluded to checklists that you've kind of compiled, the checklist over time. Can you talk a little bit more about your process overall, starting with idea generation and then how you examine businesses and ultimately make the decision to invest?
Yes, absolutely. Generally speaking, when people refer to value investing, is it seems to be all encompassing. But I love the quote, which is all intelligent investing is value investing. And even within value investing, I think there's many different approaches and strategies that are taken. You know, over the years, we've sort of tried to focus on those timeless, almost irrefutable laws or principles that apply through all cycles at all times. And that list really only consists of three things that we've figured out so far, and it's those three things that essentially form the foundation of our investment approach. And they are, you know, very simply that the more certain an outcome is, the lower the likely expected return should be. Secondly, any asset, doesn't matter whether you're investing in equities or bonds or unlisted or derivatives, ultimately is worth the net present value of its future cash flow stream. And then lastly, and again, this is the sort of owner mentality approach to investing, is if you essentially were given an opportunity to buy 100% of a business and you owned it forever, your return will essentially equate to the return on invested capital. And things like changing pricing metrics, whether it's PEs or price to books, are essentially meaningless and probably immaterial in the overall contribution to the return profile. So, you know, with that in mind, we went about sort of setting up the investment approach, which is this one that we still follow today, which has at its center understanding the incremental return on capital that a business is able to generate in the future. It's, you know, in doing that, it is obviously important to understand historically how well the company has done, how good the management team has been in terms of allocating capital, but that doesn't tell the whole picture. In fact, in many cases, the history can be somewhat misleading. So for us, looking at return on invested capital, ultimately in growing shareholder value over time, it comes down to simply what is the return that's generated out of the capital that's invested, and how many opportunities does that management team to take each dollar of cash and reinvest it back into growth opportunities. You know, a great example of just going back to sort of about 10 years ago or so, we did a deep dive into the platinum sector in South Africa. They had been one of the darlings of our stock market in South Africa and globally. Had performed exceptionally well on the back of very high commodity prices. And we went and sort of did a per shaft analysis. So rather than per company, looking at the returns that all of the mining shafts in South Africa were actually generating. And what we noticed was quite an interesting trend, is that over time, while the historic returns looked incredible because of the high platinum prices, the incremental returns were diminishing year after year for the previous decade. And in essence, that, you know, formed a much stronger view of the future in trying to understand where the industry was going than what they'd done, say, in the last 3, 5, or 10 years. The conclusions from the research that we'd arrived at was that, you know, when you're sinking one of these deep shafts that go 1,500 or 2,000 meters into the ground, it costs you at the time probably around 10 billion rand. That number's probably closer to 30 today. And you mine that over the life of mine. But the first ore that you mine essentially is close to the shaft. So your costs are low, you get it out the ground quickly. And as the life of mine extends, so you're moving further away from the shaft. And in addition to the fact that labor costs were increasing every year at sort of real rates above inflation, which was also contributing to higher costs, those two factors were leading to deteriorating economics. And if you didn't do that on a per shaft basis, I think you would have perhaps missed it. So that's sort of how we apply this principle of return on incremental capital. The second key pillar, and there are three of them, essentially. So the first one relates very much to the moat and the sustainability of the moat on a look forward basis. The second one is very much around management and their track record. you know, in the world of investing and looking at businesses, it doesn't matter how much of a deep dive you do. There's just too many variables that ultimately are going to impact the outcome of an investment. And at some point, you know, you do take a bit of a leap of faith in backing the management team. And so we do love to meet with management teams on several occasions. We don't obviously take what they say at face value. We recognize generally that the management teams look at things through rose-colored glasses. So we do like to evaluate the track record independently. So as to avoid, you know, misjudging management, and there have certainly been cases in the past where we have misjudged management. And again, those are some of the things that we bring back into our investment process and the checklist. So on our checklist of 80 items, about 25 or so relate specifically to the management team. And they vary from sort of the hard facts, understanding how the CEO or senior leadership in the business got to the positions that they're in, how successful they had been in previous positions, but also down to, you know, simple behavioral factors, understanding particularly, you know, how candid they are in communicating with shareholders and stakeholders in general. You know, are you as likely to get the bad news with the good news? And that I found has been a fantastic indicator in terms of, you know, the reliability of management as well. So just meeting management once off, I don't think is sufficient. And then sort of more recently, because of, and it's been quite interesting, you know, the increased incidences of perhaps fraud. We spent a lot of time going back and doing due diligences more on a person's character and traits. So we look, for example, using lots of social media platforms at who CEOs and leadership are friends with, what business relationships they have outside of the company. I mean, as an aside, and, you know, slightly on the humorous side, but relevant nonetheless, you know, we found a trend, for example, where CEOs that are involved in the horse racing industry are typically, you know, to be trusted somewhat less than others. So just some interesting insights that we've had over time. So, you know, other important things in terms of management is understanding the culture, because we do believe that culture is a source of a sustainable competitive advantage as well. Particularly when you're taking a long-term view on the business, you want to know that business can outlive its CEO or the current management team. And that's why we also like to go to their offices as well to get a bit of a feel. We do, you know, we often do site tours or factory tours. And it's not necessarily about getting an understanding of what condition the kit is in, but it's more around understanding the culture in the business and do they actually live it. Compensation is another important aspect with management. And again, we want to ultimately ensure that the incentives are that align the management team with shareholders. And then the sort of last key point from a management point of view is understanding their risk appetite. You know, we have often, where mistakes are made is where you see management teams that believe that there's sort of one strategy that will transform a business. And we often see that as a massive red flag. We much prefer management teams that are focused on sort of small incremental benefits each year that ultimately at least maintain, but preferably actually widen the moat over the medium to longer term. And then just lastly on the management team, and I think it's fairly safe to say this applies generally for businesses, is the importance and focus on innovation and the role of creative destruction essentially in companies. So, you know, another fantastic example is in an old smokestack industry being the paper sector. And you may think, well, there's not great returns to be had. It's a declining industry subject to significant headwinds. But there's two global paper companies, Mundi and Sappi. Both of them had their roots in South Africa. And Mundi moved very quickly to focus on consumer packaging. And that business has done incredibly well. Now, their margins have increased significantly over the last 10 years, generating great return on invested capital. And that was just about a management team with the right strategy and successfully executing on it, even though the industry itself had significant headwinds. You compare that to likes of Sappi that focused on graphic paper. You know, that management team was a bit sleepy, didn't make the same shift. They're doing that now. And, you know, the difference in performance over 10 years is material. So that's something else that we, you know, look for in the management teams as well of the companies we invest in. And then the last sort of key pillar of the investment philosophy and approach obviously has to come down to valuation and the relationship between price and intrinsic value. And we adopt perhaps a slightly different view here in that we think, you know, valuation is not an exact science. And it's typically the last thing that we look at. So, I mean, I love the story that Warren Buffett relayed in one of his shareholder letters when he talks about one of the biggest mistakes they almost made, which was not to buy See's candy at the time. And there was a price on the table and they were trying to squeeze, I think it was an extra $5 million out of it. And Warren was almost about to turn down the transaction. I think it was Charlie that said to him, look, you know, for the extra $5 million, let's go for it. And he said, you know, the economics of the business at the end of the day far outweighed the extra $5 million they paid for it. And that's sort of the approach that we tend to adopt. So while it's important to pay the right price, and we recognize that even good companies can make bad investments if you overpay for them, it's certainly not the starting point in our approach to identifying great businesses. And this concept of margin of safety for us as well involves a lot more than just discount to intrinsic value. It's about minimum of quality in not only the past performance, but also the current financial position. But ultimately, it is for us important to understand why there's a mispricing opportunity and you know what is going to result in it changing. And I think it's quite interesting given the period that we're in now, because typically, you know, the biggest mispricing opportunities tend to arise when market participants all think and act similarly towards whether it's an industry or a company. In other words, you don't get this breakdown in diversity. And I certainly think that that's probably the case in some of the sectors around the world right now, particularly if you look at the tech or consumer services space in particular. So, yeah, I mean, in conclusion, I would say in looking at those, the approach and the three pillars that we take, we acknowledge that generally speaking, all investments that we look at are going to have something wrong with them. You know, either if the price is cheap, it's a weak management team or deteriorating economics, or alternatively, you know, if the economics look great and the management team are fantastic, it may look too expensive. And we kind of see our job and our role as, you know, understanding what potentially is wrong with the investment case and formulating a view as to whether we think what's wrong is a game changer or not. And then, you know, a great sort of approach and summary of that is the way that Charlie Munger talks about the pari mutuel betting system. You know, simply investing or placing a bet on the best horse is not necessarily a winning strategy. One has got to look at the odds. And for us, that's about the upside potential versus the downside risk.
Great. Well, that's very helpful. Could you just remind us about your investment universe? How broad is it, the kinds of companies you look at in terms of geography and market caps?
Yes, so we run both local and global strategies. So the local strategies that are particularly focused on the South African market. And in that strategy, we look across the entire universe from large caps right down to smaller caps. So in our South African-based strategies, we actually have quite a large weighting towards smaller cap stocks, certainly relative to many other investment managers in the country. So we typically have between 15 and 20% in those smaller cap stocks. I had managed specifically small cap specific strategies in SA. And I think, it's that cycle sort of comes and goes. So there's a time where smaller cap stocks do particularly well. And that's great. But there are also periods like we've seen for the last 5 years or so where they tend to lag the rest of the market. So right now, we think, and it's probably not only peculiar to South Africa, but globally, that this is probably one of the biggest mispricing opportunities. Everybody is chasing the big cap tech stocks, the FANG stocks. And for the reasons that I highlighted earlier, the impact that index investing is having, these stocks are not well covered. And certainly in my 20-year investment career, there have only been two occasions in the past where smaller cap stocks have traded at these sort of bargain basement prices. So we've actually just recently launched a small cap specific strategy to capitalize on some of the opportunities that we're seeing now. And to give you an idea, I mean, in SA, the small cap universe is currently trading at a discount to its net asset value. Now, we don't necessarily rely heavily on net asset value as an indicator of what the intrinsic value of a business is, but we've never seen this before in the last 20 years or so.
I know your experience with smaller companies goes all the way back to your time at Franklin Templeton. And there's a terrific article you wrote recently on investing in small caps amid the COVID crisis. It's available on the Denker Capital website, and I would encourage all our listeners to find it and take a look at that. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about some of the lessons learned from investing in smaller businesses.
Yes. There's a wonderful song that comes to mind. I think it's in the movie Annie. It's a hard knock world. Make no mistake. It's interesting to me because when I started my career, a lot of trainee analysts were put into the smaller cap space to build up their experience. Maybe because you're dealing with businesses that are easier to get on top of. But it's an area in which you need, I would argue, a huge amount of experience because you cannot rely on other information. There is very little information available, and you have to go and do your own detailed due diligences. So, if one has a look at a lot of the studies, they say that small cap value is one of the few free lunches available. And I would argue that it's definitely not a free lunch. If you in particular look at the number of gravestones in that space, it's quite significant. A lot of businesses that are going through difficult times tend to pass through the small cap universe on the way to zero. It's very tempting when you look at simply, how far share prices have fallen to say, well, these businesses look cheap and could make for potentially attractive opportunities. So, some of the big lessons we've learned and the things that we do in our due diligence there is we're not afraid to really roll up our sleeves and do the detailed work. So, typically what we'll do and have done in the past. I can take some IT companies, for example. You know, we would get client lists from the company, and obviously with their permission, we would randomly choose, say, 20 of the largest clients and go and interview these clients to get an understanding as to how good the company has been in terms of delivering its service and value to clients over time. Are clients likely to renew? And this is sort of research that is obviously not available, but you do gain some really incredible insights. You know, in terms of lessons, some of the things that have been very important to us is to look at the audit firm that's involved. And I think that probably now speaks broadly as well to the whole universe, not just smaller cap companies. But when some of my colleagues were investing in China, that was one of the areas that was quite critical. You know, staying away from small, unknown audit firms, because that's generally where problems start. Another thing we don't do is invest in small cap mines and junior mines. They typically tend to be high cost producers. The assets that they have are small and not scalable. And you know, those two contribute to pretty poor economics for smaller cap or junior miners. And you know, they may do well once every 7 years when the commodity prices spike, but for the rest, they're generally subscale with poor economics. The other very valuable lesson is around time horizons. You know, there's a huge liquidity discount. And this also means when investing in smaller cap stocks, you're taking at least a 5-year view. And that's why, you know, doing that detailed deep dive is critical. And if you do it and you get it right, you can also, in addition to adding to those three sources of return that I alluded to earlier, you can add the liquidity discount to that as well. So, you know, if I look at the businesses that we invest in these days, we would be quite happy, you know, if the stock market only traded once a year on many of these smaller cap stocks. Because if you're buying sort of deep value, small cap stocks that have perhaps stumbled into some trouble, there's no ways you're going to be able to get out of it. You know, everybody is going to be rushing for the door at the same time. And before you blink, the share price has fallen 80%. And then maybe just, you know, lastly, and this is almost an unavoidable component of investing in outside of the large caps, is sometimes you do have to become a little bit more active in terms of unlocking value. And it's not our first choice. We certainly don't invest in companies on the basis now of wanting to change the management team. You know, we don't have the capacity to appoint or to get involved from a board perspective and determine strategy. But there have been incidences in the past where we collaborate with other shareholders. And we did that, for example, last year with the owner of the Burger King franchise in SA. And it was an interesting time. I mean, it was, it's incredibly time consuming and it invariably involves a lot of lawyers. We were trying to replace the entire board of directors, executive and non-executive. It had a fairly charismatic and flamboyant executive chairman that was running the business essentially as his own fiefdom. We'd even received threats. So there was a period of time where I'd actually had a bodyguard. It's not something you want to do too often, but it was well worth it and significant value has been unlocked and there is more to be unlocked. We generally try and avoid turnarounds for the reasons that we've highlighted. As we know, turnarounds seldom turn around and they just tend to be far too time consuming. Some of the other valuable lessons is understanding the skills that sit on the board of these smaller companies. And we do detailed due diligence on each of the board members. In South Africa, and I think particularly maybe in other parts of the world as well, being a non-exec board member has become a profession. And in many instances, these board members rely on these incomes for their livelihood. They're not there because of their skill set or because they're going to challenge the executive management team when it comes to things like remuneration or other factors. And then the last lesson, and this is probably a broader one as well, but very relevant, even more so in the smaller cap space, is just sticking to your circle of competence. I've traveled to China, I've traveled to India, I've looked at Chinese tech stocks, Chinese financial stocks, Indian pharmaceuticals. The reality is when you're trying to invest in Chinese financials out of South Africa, you have to realize that you're probably going to be the last person to hear the bad news. There are 20 other people, very smart people, that cover these companies in a lot of detail and very closely. It's just outside of your circle of competence. And so in many instances, we would be happier to have rather a smaller pond that we fish in, but be more certain of the fish that we're catching.
Rico, I'd be curious if you could talk a little bit about how you think about portfolio diversification and also in terms of industries and sectors. Are there some that you prefer over others and that you have found historically to have been successful for you?
Yeah, so we generally don't have any biases from a sector or industry perspective. The strategies that we run in South Africa don't have the same opportunities in certain industries. So we barely have, for example, a tech industry in South Africa. But obviously, from a global point of view, that's a very big component and part of what we do. So geography does have an influence on that. Coming back to our investment philosophy, there's certain traits and characteristics that we're looking for in the businesses that we invest in. And we believe that those will ultimately increase the probability of success. And so, yes, there will be some industries perhaps where maybe those factors are not as prevalent. And it's more difficult to find businesses that meet all three of those moat, margin of safety and great management. And then as a result of that, we may have less exposure there. So a great example would be, as we've highlighted, the paper sector, or even for that matter, materials or resources. So cyclical businesses are always a concern. It's not to say we don't necessarily invest in them, but when you're investing in a cyclical business, you're always having to think about when you're going to sell or exit. And that's not generally the way that we like to approach our investments in the stocks that we own in the portfolio. So, there's no particular biases. We do, in terms of sort of allocating capital to stocks that we've identified as being attractive candidates. We use some quantitative tools and methods. We've developed something we call the capital governance model. And it's based, it incorporates actually three different areas. One is the very famous and well-known Kelly criterion. The other one is mean variance optimization and the Omega function. And essentially what we're doing, when we look at the opportunities and we've done an assessment of what we think the value is worth, as we said, you know, we don't think that valuing is an exact science, so we come up with a range of outcomes. That range gives us a sense of what the probability weighted upside is in all of the investment opportunities versus the probability weighted downside. And that ultimately is how we land up sizing positions in the portfolio, which, you know, coming back to your original question, has very little to do with industry exposures or country exposures.
You talked about your strong focus on management quality, and also alluded to that example where you became activist, perhaps not by choice, but successfully so. Could you talk a little bit about your general approach to building relationships with management teams? Is there a type of frequency that you like in terms of interacting with them? And let us know a little bit about how you build that relationship and rapport over time.
Yes, so definitely. We do like to meet with management teams several times before we invest. You know, we think it's very hard within a short meeting of an hour or 2 hours even to really formulate a strong view or opinion about the management team. You know, a lot of work would obviously have been done before we meet with them to understand their track record and doing background checks. And then for companies that we are invested in, we generally meet with them at least twice a year. It's been a little bit more difficult in these times where travel has been restricted, but we have and continue to meet over Zoom or Microsoft Teams, but it's not the same. You know, we actually want to sit across the table. We want to observe and watch body language when certain questions are asked. And that's why we also always go two of us at least to these management meetings, because while one of you is perhaps concentrating on the questions and listening to the answers and perhaps maybe taking some notes, the other person is able to observe what is happening, and also may have a different take or view on the same answer with a different interpretation. And so two people are essential in these meetings. And I guess, globally, it's a lot more difficult. We tend to plan three or four big trips a year where we then go and set up 15 or 20 or sometimes even more meetings back to back. It's a very busy period, involves a lot of work and preparation. But access is a little bit harder, particularly in more larger cap stocks. But in South Africa, where the universe is a bit smaller, we over the sort of last 20 years have built up really good relationships with the management teams. And I know a lot may say, well, does that not create a bias in your view of a company? And that's something that we are acutely aware of. But I would say at the end of the day, the benefits that we gain offset potentially, you know, the small impact perhaps of some biases that may exist from time to time. And I think where we're fortunate is what we do as well in our meetings with management is often we're meeting with suppliers or customers of other companies that we may be looking at or we may be invested in. And that gives us a great opportunity to get some independent insights into other businesses as well. So often these management meetings are not just about the company that we're perhaps considering, but maybe other businesses as well, or even other management teams with whom these guys or ladies may have relationships with. So it's multifaceted.
Rico, this has been terrific. I've enjoyed learning about your path in investing, your investment philosophy, and how you go about implementing that at Denker Capital. Is there anything that we haven't covered, any areas that you'd still like to touch on, perhaps?
No, I think we've just about covered everything, John. I have nothing more in particular that I'd like to touch on.
Terrific. Well, it's been great having you as a member of the MY Global community, and I would be pleased to meet you in person in the future at one of our MOI events, obviously once the current COVID situation hopefully goes away.
Absolutely. I'm really looking forward to it as well, and can't wait to attend one of your upcoming conferences.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much for your wisdom and insights today, and all the best to you and the team at Denker.
Thank you, and to you.
Goodbye for now.
Yes.